Hello once again, thanks for tuning in for another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong here in Istanbul. In this podcast we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and the region. Give our Facebook page a like and or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. There are show notes and links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and please do rate or review the podcast wherever you listen to it. As I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, I'm now happy to confirm that the publisher IB Taurus has kindly updated their exclusive discount deal for members of Turkey Book Talk. In fact, they've made it even more generous than before. If you sign up as a member, you now get access to a whopping 35% discount on books published in IB Taurus's excellent Turkey Ottoman History category. IB Taurus, which is now part of Bloomsbury, has a terrific archive of well over 400 books in its Turkey and Ottoman History series, both academic and general interest. And if you decide to sign up as a Turkey Book Talk member, you receive a special code for a 35% discount on books in that series, including old-fashioned physical books, pre-orders, and ebooks. And that's far from all that a membership gets you. Members also receive transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk via email as soon as the episode is published. You also get transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive in English, which so far amounts to over 80 conversations, including a number of interviews not previously published on the podcast. And last but not least, members receive an archive of some 231 book reviews written by myself, covering various categories including Turkish and international fiction and poetry, history, politics, journalism, the Middle East and Europe. The archive was written over the course of 5 years and was previously available online, but now a Turkey Book Talk membership is the only way to access it. To become a member and help us keep going, just pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account. We post new episodes every 2 weeks, so the monthly membership price is no more than $6. If you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then you'll certainly be more than welcome. But so long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members only get charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. But now let's get cracking with our latest episode. In it, we welcome back Maureen Freely. She first appeared on Turkey Book Talk in 2016, not long after the podcast first got going, actually, if you want to have a little dig around the archives. Back then, she was talking about Sabahattin Ali and his classic novel, Madonna in a Fur Coat. This time, she joins us to discuss the life and work of Sait Faik Abasıyanık, perhaps the greatest Turkish short story writer of the 20th century, indeed one of the great Turkish writers full stop. I've been wanting to put out this podcast for a long time, so I'm very pleased to finally be able to do so. And there's no one better to speak about the subject than Maureen Freely. She translated, along with Alexander Dorr, a volume of Sait Faik's work called A Useless Man. And that volume gives an excellent flavour of Sait Faik's stories, which is sometimes sentimental, sometimes nostalgic, sometimes challenging, and sometimes very strange and dark. We discuss his work and its enduring appeal later in the conversation, but I started by asking Maureen Freely to simply introduce us to the life of Sait Faik.
So Sait Faik Abasıyanık, his full name, which he only gets when surnames are introduced in Turkey, was the son of the late Ottoman Empire and saw the disintegration and destruction of the empire as a young boy and man. And he makes his name in Istanbul writing short stories and columns. And along the way, he got to know the more colorful neighborhoods and characters of Istanbul by drinking with them a great deal. And of course, that's what took him in the end, alcohol.
Yes, he died at the age of just 46. I think he suffered from cirrhosis of the liver, which it's an indication of a life spent carousing and enjoying the finer things of life on Burgas Ada. And he came from quite a well-to-do family, as I gather?
He came from a well-to-do family, but like all families, it was very much dispersed and partly destroyed by the economic collapse of the empire. Some of his most intriguing stories go to the land he knew as a boy in the countryside. There is a really haunting one about a boy who's taken by his father, who's living with his wife's family, not a sign of prosperity, and he takes his teenage son to another village to meet his second family, but he never explains anything before, during, or after. It's a really, really beautiful, haunting story about this other family that he grows to love just by meeting them once, but never being able to actually exchange any explanations or any words. We just have the images. And there's another early story of his which I love a lot. A character, the hero of that, is somebody from the working world. It's a thief trying to steal things from a factory in Bursa who falls to his death. It's a very, very beautiful, really, really sad, haunting story of working life. Perhaps his most famous story is the Samovar, which almost idealizes the working boys and men of Istanbul along the Golden Horn. Again, that's a story in which a mother and his boy are just making do by the work that the boy does in a factory crossing the Golden Horn each day. And then his mother dies and he can't really face it for a very long time. So again, it has these images of working life along the Golden Horn in the center of Istanbul, the waterway that separates the old city from the so-called European city. Once you've read the story, which seems very, very simple and simply told, you cannot cross the Gotha Bridge over the Golden Horn without thinking of that story and also seeing the Golden Horn through the eyes of the bereaved boy. Another of my really favorite stories is about two men who share a room in a lodging house, but they work very, very different hours, so they're very seldom there together. I think one's a factory worker and one works on the port. They fall wordlessly. This is a leitmotif in many of the stories, wordlessly, but quite deeply in love. Of course, they can't admit it to themselves, but when they go to films and they see Hollywood actors and actresses kissing each other, they just wish that they could do the same. And then a moment arrives when the one who's working on the ships has an argument with his boss and has to leave and go to work at the Pasha Basha glass factory. And the one left behind is very, very cross. But they go and sit on the Galata Bridge one last night and they look at the barges going underneath the bridge. And one of them says, "How I wish I could just fall into that grain." And the other one says, "I wish so too." You have the sense that they have at least that one moment of shared love after which life is going to take them apart. I could go on and on. You probably want me to stop. Stop there.
No, that is a very lovely story, and it touches on an aspect of Syed Faik's life that actually often goes unmentioned, and that was his homosexuality. He never married, but apparently he had a number of affairs with men, nothing particularly serious, and often kept quiet even today. It's very rarely mentioned, yes, about him. Also, the issue isn't really sort of writ large in many of his stories. So I just wonder if, apart from the one you just mentioned, I mean, is there any reflection that you can detect in his work of that aspect of his life?
Absolutely. And I think what happens is that because he got anthologized for Turkish school children, there are certain stories of his that they choose as suitable for children and they leave the others out. In fact, there are lots and lots of very dark stories. And one of the fun that Alexander Daw and I had was to go and seek out those darker, very mysterious stories. They're not all sweet. There's a very disturbing, really interesting story about a man who is besotted with sort of a street boy or somebody who might work in the bars or whatever, part-time rent boy or whatever, but he cannot control him and so he keeps him captive. It's a story about sexual violence that stays with one and returns to one while walking certain back streets. There's another one called Night Work, which is about a meyhane, a tavern where the gangsters hang out. It seems to be near the Galata Bridge, probably near Karagöy. And there are lots of prostitutes in there with the gangsters. There's a lot of rough talk. But what they're looking for that night are boys who are possibly partly homeless, but small enough to get through windows to help the thieves. And they find one in this meyhane, and then they take him to some sort of barge or boat where there are a lot of other homeless boys being put up, and they have some sort of horrible master. And we leave them there, but we can know that they're not going to live very long, these boys. It's a very, very creepy, but again, beautifully written insight into the Istanbul underworld. know, these are just some of his darker stories. Because he wrote so many stories, it's very, very easy to leave these out. And also to leave out the quite extraordinary accounts that he left. He was a court reporter, and he did these wonderful accounts of the petty criminals and also murderers of Istanbul. The other way in which he's been sentimentalized is as a chronicler of the Istanbul that was so much nicer when it was more multicultural, when there were more Greeks and Armenians sharing everyday life. There are lots and lots of these stories in which, again, he does not allude to the historical background, but I don't read those stories as sentimental. I read them as being about lost friends. They can look a lot more sentimental if they're just put next to the nice stories that are anthologized for school children. It's also because he was a writer who was as eloquent in his gaps as he was in what he set down on the page. So you can, if you're anthologizing and romanticizing, you can just pretend that those gaps aren't there.
And that really is something that's always referenced with him. We mentioned Burguzada, where he lived most of his life. And at the time that he lived there, it was, well, historically, it was very closely associated and still populated by the kind of minorities of Istanbul, Greeks, Armenians, yeah. Jews. There's still a few descendants of these communities living on the island, but the influence was much more closely felt in Sait Faik's day. And obviously, many of his stories feature characters from these groups in a very organic, natural, unforced kind of way.
Yeah, they were just characters in the neighborhood, and that's how he and everybody else saw them. Again, the Burguzada stories have, you know, wonderful accounts of this priest and, you know, that uncle and so on. One of the stories I like most, I guess you can tell that I like the disturbing stories, is about a family that goes to live in one of the distant houses on the island, and they don't really get to know anybody. And then one day the wife comes and says her husband has died, and could people help her with the funeral arrangements? But because she has no family and people don't know quite who she is, she's not Greek, she's not Armenian, she's not Turkish, she has no family. And so they don't really help her. And in the end, it's implied that she had to roll his body off a cliff. And it's also implied that afterwards she got on a ferry penniless and threw herself off the side. But it's again told in this way of the villagers or the islanders not quite taking responsibility for what happened. There's a coldness to it, which is artful. I don't think it's Sait Faik's coldness. It's the coldness of the islanders who won't reach out and help the people they cannot see as their own.
Now, his family home on Burguzada, where he lived, has in recent years been converted into a museum dedicated to his life and work. It's this multi-story, very beautiful old white wooden mansion, really, and nicely restored a couple of years ago. It's run by the Daru Shafaka Foundation, which is a charity mostly looking after disadvantaged orphaned children. And Sait Faik, as I gather, donated his entire estate to that foundation on his death.
It's a school. It's a very distinguished school. Yes. It was when I was a child, and we knew many people who taught there. And I think that he knew many of the orphaned boys who were schooled there. And I think that's part of the reason for his legacy. Again, a very quiet, genuine way of looking after the people who are not looked after by those around him in so many of his stories.
And the museum itself is free entry, so it's definitely worth visiting. It's certainly worth taking a trip to visit it. There's also a statue of Sait Faik close to the ferry station on Burguzada. And in the afterword to the collection that you translated, you have some pretty sharp things to say about that statue, I noticed.
Yes, that was Alex Dodd being sharp. So what did he say?
He just describes it, I think, as a monstrosity, or it just says it's a very unbecoming statue that Sait Faik would probably be deeply ashamed of today.
Yes, well, we have our own little story about Burguzada, Alex Dahl, and I, you know, as I said, the joy of doing an anthology of short stories is deciding which ones to bring in and which ones to leave for another time. And Alex Dahl then and now lived on Burguzada, very close to the museum. And he didn't have Wi-Fi in his house, so he would go down to the cafes and sit there. And we would work through the screen. In other words, we'd Skype and we wouldn't see each other, but we'd be both looking at the text that we had pulled up to discuss. And the fisherman used to get very, very cross with him. I had this wonderful, you know, sitting in Bath in the middle of winter, this wonderful thing going on in the background, you know, people getting their kiftas and so on and asking for more beers and more rakas or whatever they're having. And every once in a while, the fisherman would come up and harangue him for being mad and talking into a screen. But it was so wonderful for me on the other side of the continent to be electronically right there next to the monstrous statue and the fishermen who write out of the stories.
Now, Tayfik is widely seen, perhaps really, as the number one Turkish short story writer of the 20th century. And stylistically, it's quite a varied quality to a lot of his stories. You know, some are deeply loved and well-known and almost sentimental, but others, as you mentioned, are more sort of cryptic, fragmented, with an often rather dark twist. What do you think it is about Tayfik and his work that continues to carry this appeal today?
Well, again, he was so prolific and wrote in so many different modes, not just almost sentimental and dark, but often really very, very, very funny. There's a wonderful story about milk and trying to give up the sauce and drink milk instead, which is hysterically funny. So I think because he had to make a living writing these stories, he wrote in whatever mood he happened to be in that day. But whatever he wrote, whether it was funny, observational, dark, he wrote from a certain position, which he did not need to spell out for people to feel. I certainly feel it every time I read his stories. He is somebody who does not belong, mostly because of his sexuality. So he is an insider outsider. He could have been part of the establishment, but emotionally, he wasn't, you know, the man that the establishment demanded he should be. And I would put it to you that none of us are. Certainly, no one reading him in the Istanbul of the mid-20th century would have felt themselves absolutely conforming to the very, very rigid gender and class and ethnic categories to which, you know, they were being assigned. The monolithic assertion that there was such a thing as a true Turk, and if you were a little bit Armenian or Greek or Jewish or a woman or not the full-blooded male, then you weren't quite up to scratch. And I think the comfort that readers felt at home in his stories, they felt comfortable and they could feel that without any fear of being caught out. When I was translating these stories with Alex Daw, I had just lost my husband at the time that we began work. And I did a lot of translation during those first 2 years because it was a refuge. And the place where I felt most at home and most understood and safest was in the middle of translating a story by Said Faik. He's so conversational and often so slapdash that it's easy to forget how very artful he was in his writing. Often in the first paragraph or two of a story, he does magical things, or he casts a spell leading you to have certain expectations and to see certain things that he then goes on to upturn later on.
Also, the world he describes is today almost entirely gone. You know, that old Istanbul, almost the old Istanbul of Ara Güler's photos in a way. Perhaps it appeals also to a certain sense of nostalgia among some people.
It does appeal to nostalgia. I do meet people who want to talk about Said Faik and what Said Faik meant to them. There's one that I particularly remember, and it's a diplomat's wife, Turkish diplomat's wife, who said, well, of course, I love Said Faik stories because I grew up in Kurtuluş, and in Kurtuluş there were so many Greeks and Armenians when I was growing up, and who knows, maybe we were one of them too, I don't know. Again, there's a secret fraternity that a diplomat's wife would say something like that to me. It's a careful but still shared secret that identities are far more complex in Turkey than almost everybody except Said Faik allows. I still see Said Faik's Istanbul everywhere, not in the buildings, which have perhaps briefly been cleaned up before they're destroyed again in the old Beyoğlu. But the poverty is still everywhere. It's close enough to touch. So, in fact, very little of what he captures is in the buildings and in the landscape. Really, he's looking at people and their gestures. And, of course, choreographing the way they communicate without words. And I see this everywhere. I could be on a spanking new Turkish bus and I would be able to see that. I would see it in any one of the millions of shared taxis that go up and down all of the highways and motorways. So the everyday rituals, habits of speech of people, I see it. I certainly see it wherever people are drinking raka. There might be more women of a respectful background in these vehanas, but it's still the same sway and dance, which I think I appreciate most when I'm just back in Istanbul and I haven't been back for more than a day or two. After that, I just go into the flow. But the first few days, I'm seeing things that only happen in a city like Istanbul, no matter how grotesquely mega city it becomes.
It's funny, I mentioned there Ara Güler briefly. I don't know if you've had a chance to read yet, but just before he died, this new selection of his Ara Güler stories and writings from his younger years, basically before he picked up a camera, was published. And I was thinking as I was reading those stories, they really do share very similar kind of character with Sait Faik. He was writing those stories at around, or just after really, Sait Faik died, I think. Very short pieces, often focused on a single character, quite free-flowing and impressionistic, a lot of fishermen in them. There's a very strong similarity between those Ara Güler stories and the typical Sait Faik story, I guess.
Well, I don't think it would be stretching it to say that, you know, the live tradition of Sait Faik, which goes on after his death and is still with us, would have been a very, very powerful influence on Ara Güler, not just in his early writings, but in his photographs, which are so often stories in themselves. The fisherman, you know, the wonderful famous photograph of a messenger with a helmet asleep on a spike on his sokol. The very, very poor couples, you know, village arrivals from the village making their way down those dark streets. Of course, he also photographed the, you know, the great characters of Beowulf. All of these wonderful people were, you know, not part of the Istanbul establishment at all. They were part of the, you know, Beowulf Bohemia, and they all looked after each other. They were all short of money all of the time. They were often in those cafes and meyhanes because they had no heat at home. And it was, while it lasted, a wonderful society. I'm sure if you look, you would find other secret societies now of writers, particularly journalists, who can no longer sell their wares, who are looking after each other.
And what about the translation process? I mean, you translated the volume that was published a few years ago jointly, as you mentioned, with Alexander Dorr. So it was a collaborative process. I mean, how was that process? What were the nuts and bolts of it? What are the particular quirks of Sait Faik's writing that make it peculiar or difficult to translate?
As I said before, we devoted a lot of our time to deciding which stories to include. So there was an awful lot of reading and discussing of the stories, which was wonderful to do. It was just wonderful to be discussing these stories with somebody else who loved and indeed lived and breathed them. Our approaches to translation are different. He's very concerned about staying as close as possible to the Turkish text and often was undecided about when it came to synonyms. And he would be quite horrified that I would change the order of clauses in order to create a kind of music that was to my ear like the music of the original story. But again, it was lots and lots of fun to talk this through, to have two translators with different approaches coming to an agreement. Because whenever you are looking at a passage that is difficult, you get to understand it more, you get to love it more. The other wonderful thing about Sait Faik stories is that they're very short. And you could do a first draft easily in a day and then let it sit and then go back and look at it, except for those very, very tricky first paragraphs. I don't think there was a single story in which the first paragraph didn't cause me a great deal of trouble and therefore that I did not end up loving a great deal.
And, I mean, you write in the afterword that Sait Faik, quote, floated above the fray of literary rivalries and literary movements, really. But I also feel that he kind of did in a political sense. You know, these stories are determinedly non-political, and that's really their charm. Instead, they're sort of intensely human-focused, capturing scenes and impressions, really. And that's also, I think, particularly striking because so much of Turkish writing is intensely political, and people are obsessed, really, with various writers' political stance. Yeah. Over and above their work. work. I mean, do you think this kind of floating above the political fray was a deliberate choice taken on Syed Faik's part?
I think that floating above the political fray is a political act. It's saying I will not be forced to deny the humanity of my multifarious characters just so that I can choose one of your political positions. And so, again, there are lots of very fine Turkish writers who, you know, managed to be very political and also brought humanity through their stories. Nazım Hikmet would be, you know, a shining example of that. Sabahattin Ali is an example of a writer who did not conform to the ideas of his quote-unquote elders and betters, who were somewhat perplexed by the things he wrote in mid to late career because they thought they were too quote-unquote womanly. So Syed Faik would have been drinking in his meyhanes with these people or avoiding these people by going into the very rough meyhanes. That might have been another reason why he took refuge in the underworld. And it takes a lot of art in Istanbul of the mid-20th century to be turning out stories as frequently as Syed Faik did and somehow managing not to get caught up in anybody's net. But I think that is where a lot of the art of his stories comes in. How to phrase and frame things, begin and end things in such a way that by the time he's through, he's gone off into the shadows again and they've enjoyed the story he's just written, but they don't quite know why. So I do think that's a political act, not to conform and not to get caught while not conforming, and actually to make people laugh and cry and see themselves in a way that they don't really want to admit.
So I just wonder if, to conclude, we could, if I could just ask you to introduce and read a passage of Syed Faik's work that you particularly would like to share. Just introduce it and tell us why that you've selected it for us.
I've chosen The Little Coffee House because its opening paragraph is one that gave me a great deal of trouble, and I came to love it very much, partly because of the time I spent on it, and mostly really because the image it gave me was so powerful. I'll read the passage and then I'll explain a little bit about why I think it's so powerful, why it stayed with me in the context of this story. I came often in the summers to sit in the garden of this little coffee house, and so no one thought it strange when I walked in that evening through swirls of snow and a ferocious northwest wind. The coffee house was in a quiet and secluded neighborhood. The bare branches of the willow trees that made the garden so charming in the warm months were now coated with snow, and so too was the vine from which three or four dry leaves still dangled. And I was so entranced by the scene I had just glimpsed that I reached over to the misty window and rubbed a patch clear, and there it was again, that bright white glow rising from every root and the air tinged with violet. Night fell so quickly that the violet was gone before the lights came on inside. As the proprietor set the loveliest of his tea glasses on my table, he said, "It's beautiful here in winter too, isn't it?" So that is something that I hope now flows. It really, really flows beautifully in Turkish. But because of the structure of Turkish, the coffee house through which the narrator walks to look out the window at the same garden he's just passed through can be presented as a unity. And the clauses that give us the vine with three or four leaves still tangled and the bright white glow rising from every root and the air tinged with violet all become part of the same image that brings out the summertime garden and the wintertime garden and the snow and the dusk all into this beautiful unity. And that's what I was trying to do. It's such a tricky sentence that I once gave it to a group of translator friends with whom I was doing a workshop in Istanbul. And 3 hours later, we were still arguing and we had not come up with any solutions. For me, for the story, you have this sense of this little beautiful haven off the beaten track where life goes on the way it did before everybody else got so modern and the rest of the city got so modern. And that is this wonderful, beautiful atmosphere that we go on to enjoy inside this coffee house. However, by the end of the story, something so ugly and so terrible has happened that it really cuts into you. And it cuts into you because he has lulled you into this haven of beauty and peace beforehand. So that's an example of how he is so artfully, you don't see the art until he has done thing at the end of the story to stab you in the heart.
That was Maureen Freely. Very many thanks to her. Remember to consider signing up as a Turkey Book Talk member if you enjoy the podcast and want to help support it. Membership gets you access to that special renewed 35% discount on Turkey Ottoman history books published by IB Tourism Bloomsbury. Transcripts in English and Turkish of every interview as it's published. Transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive of over 80 conversations so far. And access to an archive of 231 book reviews written by me covering Turkish history and politics, literature and various other things. To become a member and get all that, just pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account, and if you're personally not sure, then why not consider signing up as a gift for a friend or colleague who may be interested. Also, do please rate or review Turkey Book Talk on iTunes or whatever podcast platform you use. You can follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay fully updated with new episodes, and you can send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.